Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great time to be here. I have never been to Toronto. I'm glad I could come here and visit. I had a great day already. And I would like to tell you a little about these simulations that I've been doing for materials at high pressure. And to make this fun and entertaining, I have one very unusual request. It goes very much against your tradition here. I would like you to sit very close and tight next to each other. So I'm very serious about this. I do this with my class also. I would like you, everybody sitting on the outside and everybody in between, to move in and fill every seat. Yes, please. So the more tightly you're packed, the better it will work, I promise. So if you don't want to move, you're fine. So we want to form a tight crystal structure, as will come apparent. So I have some gadgets here. Yes, I thought you could sit there, but since everybody else left, you have to come down too. Everybody gets two of those, and the meaning will be apparent. Don't grab more than two hydrogen atoms. That will be too greedy. Two of those. And I need two. Yeah, so if you could fill the seats in between, any point in between will be detrimental to the experiment. Okay. So if you, I don't know, you on the right, you could move in preferably, that would be nice. Okay. So if you're sitting off, you're in a very high energetic state that's unfavorable to normal materials. So, but otherwise it looks very nice. So two of you, every one of you should get no more than two hydrogen atoms, and everybody should have two. So the meaning of this whole game will be apparent in a second. So I approach planetary science from a very atomistic point of view, and we use condensed matter simulations to say something about materials at high pressure, and we compare with high-pressure experiments to gauge the validity of these methods on an almost constant basis. I'm running in open doors here by telling you it's exciting to talk about these things just because of the Kepler mission. It completely changed our point of view of the universe, because for the first time we can nail down one of the numbers in the Gray equations by saying how many planets orbit a typical star. What is the chance of finding a certain number of planets for a given star in a certain distance? So this is a satellite that was launched into orbit. It stars at a large number of stars and detects transit events by looking for small dips in the brightness of the star for small eclipse events. So even it cannot see these planets directly, it can indirectly infer its presence by having repeated dips according to the orbital periodicity of the planet. So if you look at what was known before this mission flew, these were in 2009, the different planets given here as a function of relative size to Earth. So that would be a Jupiter planet, or this would be a Uranus or Neptune planet. That would be something close to Earth. And then given as function of orbital days. So Earth would be far off that chart over here, but many of those planets would be further in. We had about 40 planets known at that point. So you may have seen these before. Within 2 years of collecting data, the field dramatically changed. So these are all the Kepler candidates. We have 2,000 of them now. There will be another release soon of Kepler candidates. They need to be reconfirmed later on. But it completely transformed what we thought about it. There needs to be a large amount of planets in between Uranus and Earth-type planets. We all want to understand. So the field of planetary science is revolutionized just because of this one extremely successful mission. So there's the most complex system that has been found is a solar system that has six extrasolar planets, and NASA did a little animation of these things, so I'm going to show this with you here. So what the Kepler will detect only these brightness variations, and the result, they come as a result of several of those planets orbiting at very close range. And for this particular system, they're so close to each other that they perturb each other gravitationally. And as a result, you can estimate their masses. So typically, Kepler planets come without a mass estimate. You can just give the ratio of the star diameter to the planet diameter. That you can observe directly. But in this case, since they perturb each other gravitationally, these transit timing variations also give us an estimate of the mass. So being a physicist, I would like to contribute to this field, but the question is how. And we would tell you something about these ab initio simulations that allow us to look at the interior of these planets by characterizing the forces between these atoms very accurately. So we actually do simulations on the atomistic level. So looking at the phase diagram of hydrogen, that's where I typically start. You have temperature here, starting from 100 Kelvin to a million, for example, and density ranging here over several orders of magnitude. You have Jupiter's outer envelope is molecular, and then there's a phase transition to metallic fluid. And here's the sun at very high temperature. So the materials computation is getting more and more sophisticated, but still the statement by Paul Dirac from 75 years ago is still true. He said that the fundamental laws for understanding a large part of physics and everything of chemistry, they're all completely known, but they're too complex to be solved. Literally, that statement is still correct. And the only thing we can vary now is that we add a little word exactly at the very end. I'm trying to convince you that the simulation methods we have are reasonably accurate to characterize materials to the level that we need. We have two methods that I use in my group. One is path-integral Monte Carlo, which is a very efficient way to treat systems with excited electrons. Ironically, Feynman invented this method for systems at 4 Kelvin for superfluid helium, but we're now using it for path-integral simulations at 10,000 or higher methods. And we are working with people in Livermore who try to make fusion. So this is a very good way of studying materials at 100,000 or million degrees Kelvin. And what Livermore tries to achieve is compressing a capsule of deuterium-tritium material to start fusion. You need to reach about enormous densities. That capsule needs to be contracted by a factor of 30 in diameter. And you're fighting Rayleigh-Taylor instability. So it's very challenging experiments and not clear whether it will succeed. So we contribute equation of state calculations to that field. So you also compare with other experiments. Here are shock waves where you compress materials for a very short time, and it allows you to say something about the equation of state. We've done different materials here. And we also try to do better than the traditional density functional calculations. This is one method, quantum Monte Carlo, that we used here for silica phases. A lot of development actually going when you want to enhance these methods is to do better than existing density functional calculations. At the moment, I'm using these techniques for the low temperature part, and here we applied them to hydrogen helium mixtures, and they work very, very simply. So you have a quantum mechanical calculation, so we'll just explain, and then you will solve F equals ma, so you're treating the nuclei classically, which is a reasonably good approximation in many cases. So we solved the Schrödinger equation, so this is a physics department. I don't have to explain this very much what it is. We typically start with an antisymmetric wave function. And that would be, if you optimize the different orbitals, then you come back, you derive the Hartree-Fock approximation. And typically, all the development of new methods goes into how to do better than Hartree-Fock. So if you are not familiar with this type of approach, you may have had some chemistry class where someone drew orbitals for a methane molecule. So what we do in the simulation, rather than knowing what the orbitals look like, we solve them on the fly. And then we move the nuclei according to the forces of the current position of the nuclei. And then we propagate the nuclei forward in time by resolving these forces. And that's where most of the computational time goes. So we can directly observe phase changes This is, for example, a simulation of molecular hydrogen in periodic boundary conditions, and the electrons are then forming the binding forces. We do not have to put in anything about whether the system is molecular or metallic. That's a result of the simulation by solving the quantum mechanical problem for a current configuration. And here, you force these molecules too close together that they actually form a delocalized state and the system becomes metallic. So in principle, these methods can be used to derive the equation of state of arbitrary materials. We have some limitations when it comes to very heavy nuclei, but for light elements, it works reasonably well. And for Jupiter, we can study the outer molecular envelope, and then we have a large part which is metallic. And otherwise, we have some elements mixed in. It's hydrogen and helium mostly, and then we have carbon, nitrogen, oxygen in very small proportions. So astronomers like to lump them all together and say there's just 2.7% of other stuff. So the interior structure of Jupiter is not quite well characterized because the core is not very large. For Saturn, it's different, but for Jupiter, there is a bit of a controversy. So typical models by Guyot and predecessors, they have constructed models with a very small core. So between 7 Earth masses and even close to zero. So the conundrum arises, if there's no solid core in Jupiter, how do you make the planet? The standard scenario is basically you form planetesimals that stick and have a growing core that then, when it reaches 10 Earth masses or so, then the hydrogen gas collapses. So if you have, if you constructed today's model for Jupiter's core, then you have to add an additional explanation. So we have a competing model that has a much larger core, but it introduced differential rotation. So I'm not sure either of those models is fully correct. I can probably not claim that this model is still up to date. But the best way to find out is actually do an experiment. And one of them is actually on the way. The Juno mission was launched in 2011. It's going to fly by here next year. And it arrives at Jupiter in 2016. So it will measure magnetic field and gravity fields with much higher precision than currently possible. So hopefully we'll get some answers. I will try to provide a few based on these ab initio simulations. And the question that we were after in the last couple of years is if you start with a simple-minded view that there's one large convective cell that mixes the whole envelope of the planet, what mechanism could introduce any compositional gradients? What would it be possible not to have a completely homogeneous envelope for Jupiter? And the first one that was proposed, if there's this regime here, we have the transition from molecular to metallic, maybe there is a first order phase transition associated with it, and that could introduce a compositional gradient. So based on all the calculations we've done with intensity functional theory, this transition is continuous. And there's no first order phase transition, just molecules dissociate gradually. And this is not a way to introduce a compositional gradient. Then there are two more things that were proposed. There's helium rain, and I will come back to that. That's the next point of the talk. And also there's the possibility of eroding this core by bringing heavy material up in the molecular envelope. So the story about helium rain goes as follows. If you look, there was one probe that was sent into Jupiter's atmosphere, and it measured the composition in situ. This is very rare. It was the Galileo entry probe. And what it did measure, it compared the elemental abundances plotted as a function for different elements compared to solar. So you find that carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, they're all enriched, and also the heavy noble gases are enriched. That's not so difficult to explain. Because the standard assumption is Jupiter grabbed gas from the protosolar nebula. It should have exactly the same composition as the Sun. And then it may have grabbed some additional comets or some other material, or even some outgassing from the core. But to make it heavier than solar is not difficult. There are two mechanisms. You capture planetesimals, and you erode a core or something. However, you have helium, which is slightly depleted, but it's not much. But the story is basically about neon. So neon, there's 9 times less neon in Jupiter's atmosphere compared to the Sun. So there has to be some mechanism that removed neon from the atmosphere. So that's the key for actually that got us on track of looking at helium rain, because the two things may be related. So helium rain was proposed to exist in the interior of Saturn because it is a way to explain the excess luminosity. So if you construct typical models for Saturn's interior, and then you look how quickly does the planet cool as a function of time, you arrive at the current temperature within 2 billion years, and that's obviously wrong. So there's some mechanism for the interior of Saturn that is a heat source that provides additional energy to prolong its cooling so that it reaches its current state after 4.5 billion years. So Stevenson and Salpeter looked at this problem, says what mechanisms could it possibly be given that we only have hydrogen and helium, and they proposed helium rain. People didn't know where it actually occurred, but always it's a way to enrich the lower envelope or the lower layer with helium, because helium would rain out, and you deplete helium of the upper one. So that is a form of gravitational settling, and it's a heat source as a result, or an energy source at least. So it's a little bit like oil and water. You can study it theoretically by looking at the Gibbs free energy of mixing. And at high temperature, anything will basically mix. So if at low temperature, a system could assume a state of oil and water where the mixed state is no longer the state of the lowest Gibbs free energy, and the system will roll down to a hydrogen-rich phase and a helium-rich phase, for example. So if you were able to determine the Gibbs free energy of mixing, then you can study these things with a computational approach. So this has been done, and the most accurate calculation is by Morales et al., who really predicted this phase separation to occur even within Saturn. This is our calculation that we've done also. And what typically happens is the following. If you have a very hot planet, then the adiabat here as a function of temperature and pressure will be above this demixing problem. And the demixing is driven by the molecular to metallic transition in hydrogen. So helium is more an insulating substance, and it will hold on to its electron. At some point, it will no longer be preferable to be present in a metallic system. As a result, the two fluids will phase separate because one is a metallic and the other one is still an insulating fluid. That's the principal explanation. So if you have a planet that has an adiabat that is higher, then it will still have a completely mixed envelope. And as it cools, the adiabat will come down and eventually intersect the region of immiscibility. At that point, you form a very thin layer of helium rain. And as the planet keeps cooling, that layer expands. So in the layer, hydrogen will remain, and helium droplets will rain out. And that's different than the helium balloons that you may buy, because they're in competition with air, so they always go up. But if they were in competition with hydrogen, they would rain out. So unfortunately, helium rain goes down. So and as a result, that gets enriched in helium. So in Saturn, we therefore expect that helium rain must have played a much bigger role. But for Jupiter, it was not clear. There was no clear signal of a depletion in helium, and there was also no clear signature of any excess luminosity. So we took this observation that neon was depleted and asked a very simple question. We calculated the Gibbs free energy of putting the neon in a system of hydrogen, and in competition, we put it in helium. So we have to, if we trust our calculations, we do these Gibbs free energy calculations, and the hardest part is to get the entropy. So the internal energy and pressure can be calculated directly. The entropy is more tricky, and we do it in the following way. We first of all determine the density for a given pressure and temperature, and then we can calculate the difference in free energy between two systems. We have our density functional forces, and we map them onto a classical system of forces. So the difference between these two force fields in free energy can be calculated by this observable, by just measure the difference in potential energy, and then you solve this integral, and you can derive it for different values of lambda. And lambda is basically a measure of what force field you use. At one point, you use the pure DFT forces, and the other values, you use the pure classical forces. And that gives you an initial way of constructing free energies. So that's very difficult otherwise. That's the best way that exists. To calculate these classical forces is very quickly, because the classical simulations are 5 orders of magnitude faster, and that can be done very quickly. So the surprising result that we found, if you now compared neon either sticking into hydrogen or sticking the neon atom into helium, there is a strong preference. And hydrogen and neon is apparently not happy if you stick it into metallic hydrogen. So you, the system is under 1,000,000 atmospheres, so it's a little bit higher than what you may be used to or what your experiments can reach. But neon, the interactions between neon and the hydrogen are unfavorable, and it leads, first of all, to a relatively large exclusion zone around any neon atom. We don't put it in. It's a result of these underlying quantum mechanical calculations. And the volume of the neon atom is larger than if you stick it into helium. So the argument is, if you assume there is helium rain, the neon would prefer the helium droplets. So it's a mechanism for explaining why neon was depleted of the atmosphere. You can continue these calculations and determine the full Gibbs free energy. And the result is basically you can determine how big is this energy difference. That's plotted here. It's about 2 eV. And now you can construct a model. So based following the work by Rolston and Stevenson that derived this equation for the depletion of neon in presence of helium rain. If you put these things together and you compare it with the observations, we calculated that at 5,000 Kelvin, this energy difference is about 2 eV. And then we compare it to the 9-fold reduction in neon and the 1.2% reduction in helium. And all these three numbers are consistent with each other. So therefore, we have an explanation why neon is missing from Jupiter's atmosphere. And we have an indirect way to say that there is helium rain already going on this planet. That's not clear. That was not clear beforehand. So people were intrigued about these things. There was some press here in Germany, and there were some other languages. Here's some English article about this result. And already you can see that the scientific story was used to draw attention to this embezzling scheme of the British Prime Minister. And we're also very proud that we made it on the website from the mysteries, from the ancient civilizations to the UFOs. Apparently, helium rain is right there. And we also made it on the same website like Bill Gates. He got number one because he wanted to build nuclear reactors. Then we got beat by someone who is doing portable mind readers. But helium rain is already number three. So to move on, we wanted to say something about the difference between large and small planets. And what you should take away from this talk, if you don't know it already, is there's a big difference in size between the gas and the ice giants and the small terrestrial planets. So when I give a very simple explanation for this, I should tell students that is the result of the ice line. The temperature inside the disk was too high for any ice being present, so therefore the terrestrial planets grew very slowly. There was not a whole lot of solid material to cobble together to make a giant planet, so the cores of those planets grew quite slowly. So further out, there was ice present in solid form that got incorporated into the ice giants. They reached critical size more quickly, and then around 10 Earth masses, they started to track the gas. So they ended up with a huge amount of gas, while these ones didn't because they grew too slowly. So if you assume this simple-minded view, you would claim, well, there has to be a lot of ice in Jupiter's core. What's happened to that ice? So it's another way of asking the question, is it still there? Do we have a thick layer on top of Jupiter's core? or has it been eroded away? So what we can do is basically look at the energetics, how much energy would we require to erode a presumably existing ice layer. So that got us interested in water ice before, because it was not known how would water ice look like in at several megabar pressures. So water ice has, there are many different phases of water ice, and that's where you come in. For example, well, we all know it's H2O, there's a characteristic angle. We know it's a dipolar molecule with a very strong dipole moment. You have lone pair electrons here. We have positively charged hydrogen nuclei, and it likes to form hydrogen bonds. So then the other peculiar thing about water that you realize is that ice floats. So anybody have a good, simple explanation why does ice float? Any explanation? I think you're too shy.
Because it's better, the ice is better organized, but it does have the spacing.
Yes, you said it exactly right. You said, first of all, you blamed it on the ice, not on the liquid. And it is better organized. Presumably, it likes to minimize its energy. And the result of that is a relatively a large ice structure with lots of vacancies. So that's exactly what the argument we put forth also. So it is organized with large voids. So if you, at low temperature, the rule is materials go to the state of lowest Gibbs free energy, which in this case is just the lowest energy state. It doesn't say whether it should be packed or anything, no. Just the state of lowest internal energy in this case, and lots of other materials, is so unusual it forms large voids. In a liquid, you break these solid bonds or arrangements, and therefore the liquid is more dense. So the direct consequence of this arrangement is a negative Clapeyron slope for the ice 1H structure to the liquid here, just because this is the difference between the volume of the solid and the liquid determines the slope of this melting line. So what you see here already, there are many different ice phases. There's ice 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And they're all a result, if you want to approach this problem theoretically, by minimizing the Gibbs free energy for different pressures and temperatures. So how do those arise? For ice 1H, this is the ice you have in your fridge. So these hexagonal arrangements where you have the oxygen atoms are red and the hydrogen atoms are blue, these are these hydrogen bonds and these are the covalent bonds. So for every hydrogen molecule, there's two covalent bonds, and then there's a longer hydrogen bond. So if you then pressurize the ice in your fridge, for example, you go to ice 2, which is another orthorhombal rhombohedral arrangement with a different unit cell, but still composed out of different molecules. Ice 6 is a very peculiar state. This is sort of known as a self-cloth rate. This is only showing the oxygen atoms here, and it forms cages around itself. So clathrates are cage structures where something gets enclosed, like methane, and you find these things on the sea floor. Here, in this particular arrangement, water is sort of encapsulating itself. So there are many different ice phases. They're all fascinating and difficult to understand at the same time, but also follow some simple rules. So they're the Pauling ice rules. And the first one is basically every oxygen atom should have two hydrogen atoms. So basically what we want to do is we want to form our own ice structure. And that will help us understand why is there such a variety of complex ice materials. And so the first rule that Pauling put forth, every oxygen atom should have no more than two covalent bonds, meaning two hydrogen atoms. So you should put yourself in the position that you are an oxygen atom. And if you grab more than two hydrogens, you already violated this rule. So put them in your pocket. So I would like you to have those two hydrogen atoms present now. And we would like to, you are now in a crystalline arrangement. So now we should make our ice structure. We basically should figure out how to arrange our hydrogen bonds. So we have two covalent bonds. These are the thick solid lines. And now you have the possibility to direct them anywhere you want. So preferably to your neighboring oxygen atoms. Rule number two is now every oxygen atom has two hydrogen bonds. So now you should do. You should basically take your hydrogen atoms, point them some way, and the rule, back in, you have people in front of you and people behind you. So there you should have four neighbors. And the rule is in between, yeah, you should have just two, you should accept two hydrogen bonds. And you should point your hydrogen bonds in some other direction. So rule number three is in between two oxygens, there can only be one hydrogen atom. So let's just review this. Everybody has two hydrogen atoms. You point them any direction you want. And you basically should receive two hydrogen bonds. So this would not work, if I may explain this. You cannot point his hydrogen atom to her if she's already pointing this to you. You have to point it to someone over here. So can you please check this? That is actually working? So are you happy, Ryan? You're happy? Okay. Okay, so can I have everybody's attention at this point? Shh. So there's a rule number four. Says the total dipole moment of the whole unit cell has to be zero. So if you're standing, if you're holding it like that, then your dipole moment is pointing in between these two oxygen atoms. So everybody should hold their hand out in the current dipole configuration. And basically what this means is there's a simple way to arrange this. If everybody was standing this way, the whole cell would have a huge dipole moment pointing forwards into the screen, which is not energetically preferred. It would violate rule number four. So what you should also may have noticed, you had a few defects that may have made it more difficult. But if you're sitting in the middle, there's no simple way you can avoid any, you're satisfying rule 1, 2, 3. You may end up in a configuration of a high state of frustration. It's actually called that way. That you cannot satisfy. You cannot, rule out any violation of those rules without any large-scale rearrangements of atoms. So you may not have seen this. So apparently Ryan was fine, even though he was surrounded by enough neighbors. But there were enough defects. But this is actually something not only present in theory, but also in experiments. So as we will see here in a little bit. So we have I7 and 8. And 8 is an ordered arrangement of hydrogen atoms. And if you increase temperature, the hydrogen atoms will assume a disordered state. So if you kept talking too much or have too much energy and you did not quite reach the ground state, that is a ordered disorder transition. The oxygen atoms just do a local relaxation as a result. It's a typical disorder, ordered disorder transition given as a function of temperature. So coming back to the point of disorder, the last three experimentally discovered ice phases were all ordered arrangements of previously known high-temperature proton disordered phases. And this was only achieved by introducing a few defects in the crystal. So in the experiments, if you are, for example, in I7 here, you could not have produce this ICE 15 phase. Here the oxygens are disordered. They have 50-50 chance of being in either site. But by introducing a little bit of a base, they introduce defects in the crystal. And all of a sudden, everybody could sort of shift to and reach the ground state. So this was just an ordering effect by having defects present. And then these three new phases were discovered as a result. So if you go to higher pressure, all of those, what you know is ICE 10, then this is sort of pressure is so high that the distinction between a covalent and the hydrogen bond goes away. So the hydrogen atoms then sit in exactly at the midpoint between two neighboring oxygen atoms. So I'm claiming that all of those states, all of those phases were reproduced with ab initio calculations. So all of them arise, they compute the Gibbs free energy, and all these phase boundaries you can reproduce. So then sometimes they're a little shifted, we're off by 5% in density, that can happen, but all of those phases can be reproduced. So then you may trust theory then if you want to go to higher pressure. This is the calculation by Benoit et al. In 96 that showed there's this buckling effect that results if you put more pressure, then it becomes goes from a chemically dominated problem to a packing problem. So chemical forces are still important, but it becomes more a way of arranging atoms in a tighter packing. So you, overall, it's this it's the PV term in the Gibbs free energy. It starts to dominate more and more as you put systems under pressure. So this is occurs at about 3 megabars. So 3 million atmospheres. So we started, that's still not enough for Jupiter. So we wanted to go to 40 megabars to understand the core mantle boundary. So we've done a little calculation. And what we've done, what we first figured out, is that there is another structural instability. So if you take a condensed matter physics class and the professor teaches about phonons, you should pay attention. These things potentially are useful. At least for us, they're useful because they tell us something about instabilities in the structure. So here we can say that this phonon mode goes unstable because the midpoint between these two oxygen atoms is no longer preferred. You squeeze so much that the hydrogens go left and right and left and right and left and right. It's this instability that induces a new phase of water ice. So in this one paper, we also made another prediction of a metallic phase of water ice. And this turns out to be not quite correct because we published this paper in 2010, and it triggered a slew of other calculations. So just because we had one ice phase that's correct, it's this phase with the instability, but then there are lots of other papers predicting ice phases of lower Gibbs free energy, all at t equals zero. So there are now 1, 2, 3, 4 phases were predicted in between at different pressures ranging from 8 megabars to about 50. So we just put another paper out claiming that there are two more ice phases at 100 megabars. So all of these methods use probability, random search strategies. They're very simple. So any graduate student who doesn't have too much time looking for a project to do, it's very simple. You just take a unit cell, you decide how many atoms you have, you put them in random arrangements, and you take one of those ab initio codes and relax the structures. And that's already not fully explored yet. You can actually determine new phases of water ice that way. It's as simple as it is right now. You just put them at random positions, you relax the structure at a given pressure, and see if you find anything that has lower enthalpy than what's previously been performed. So the question now is that ice phase actually stable? And the question is, what are the thermodynamic conditions for Jupiter's core? It's about 40 megabars, and temperature is 15,000 Kelvin. If you ask any of your experimental friends, well, what happens at 40 megabars, then they will say they can't answer this. But if you add them this temperature, then they're even more lost, because typical diamond anvil cell experiments reach 3 or 4 megabars and are limited often to 1,000 Kelvin. Some go a little bit higher. So this is difficult to answer based on extrapolation because you have two competing effects. If you put pressure on something, you may stabilize an ice layer. If you put temperature, you can pretty much dissolve anything. If you heat it enough, anything that doesn't want to mix at low temperature will mix at high temperature just because the entropy of mixing is a very strong force. So we didn't know when we started the calculation for our ice layer, what is the preferred state? Is it a state where you have a layer of ice separated by, and have a layer of metallic hydrogen? Or the ice starts to dissolve? So the way to determine this is actually look what the oxygen atoms do. We do not solve these problems by directly simulating the dissolution process. We do this thermodynamically. We calculate the Gibbs free energy of this hydrogen phase by itself, the Gibbs free energy of this water phase, and we compare it to the Gibbs free energy of a system where oxygen atoms are dissolved into a fluid metallic hydrogen. So the surprising part is actually that the Gibbs free energy is positive at low temperature, but already at 3,000 Kelvin, it starts to go negative. So it's driven by the entropy. So there's a lot more entropy when you mix oxygen atoms in hydrogen. You just have to overcome the chemical binding in these ice phases, and as a result, the oxygen will, the ice will dissolve into the metallic hydrogen above. It happens already at 3,000 Kelvin. So if you're coming back to this diagram, there's a strong preference for dissolving all the ice in Jupiter's core. It may all be gone. We come back to that question a little bit. So to move on, so what should I probably say is there is a transition in water ice. It's fully fluid here, and it's superionic below. So we do our calculation for this phase of ice. You have to put it in the correct, have to put the ice in the correct phase. So that turns out to be out in the superionic phase. But nevertheless, it's not, doesn't matter strongly what ice phase it's in, it will dissolve nevertheless. So what we needed to calculate the Gibbs free energy of superionic ice to make this result come out. So what's the next question? If you assume the simple-minded view, all the ice is gone from Jupiter's core, well, what's next? Well, you would assume that Jupiter during its formation has also collected rocky planetesimals, and there may have been a differentiating process. You had a silicate mantle and a probably differentiated metallic core. So you ask the question, how much energy would be required to dissolve silicates or to dissolve iron? So the first thing you need to understand, again, what are those materials in? So Umemoto studied magnesium silicates and predicted that they differentiate into quartz and MgO at about 11 megabars. So we consequently focused on these two phases, so magnesium oxide and quartz, essentially, in some high-pressure form. And we did repeated the same calculation again. We looked at the Gibbs free energy that it would take to dissolve MgO. And what we find is that it's in Jupiter also has the possibility to erode MgO in different concentrations plotted here. And for Saturn, we're not quite sure. So Saturn depends on what precise model do you adopt for Saturn's interior. Some predict a relatively high temperature, then MgO would dissolve. Some may predict a relatively low temperature, and then the solubility may be somewhat limited. So as a result, Jupiter definitely rocky core material will dissolve. So we have since extended the calculation to also look at silicon oxide, and we see a very similar trend as for MgO, but at the moment we're working on iron to study this process. And we find that Jupiter is likely to dissolve all of those processes. So now let's just look what are the real implications. All I've shown is that's energetically preferred for these core materials to dissolve into hydrogen. But it's not obvious what the long-scale implications for the planet really are. There are three scenarios. If you assume that there's a lot of thermal energy available in these giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, then they are rapidly convecting. So anything that you dissolve into hydrogen will be homogenized in the planet very quickly. Then the core that we now see today may have been much, much bigger originally. And the Galileo probe that measured the oxygen and the carbon abundances in the planet may have measured some that were originally in the core. But you don't have to assume that view, because based on the ab initio simulations that we have, I cannot attach a time scale to the large scale erosion process. You can take the complete opposite view and you say it's very slow in both planets. In this case, the convection of this heavy core material is far too slow to make any big impact. So you can say there's a little bit of dissolution going on, but the material is too heavy to be brought up. In this case, if the Juno mission arrives to Jupiter and measures these things, it would not detect, it would detect a large core, presumably, which and the core erosion or core dissolution could not be detected. So there is this intermediate scenario you could adopt, and you can say, well, Jupiter is this bigger planet, has more thermal energy it has to get rid of. It's a more rapid convector, and therefore core erosion was faster in Jupiter, and maybe the core in Jupiter has shrunk substantially. And maybe in Saturn, there's not enough energy around, and core erosion was comparatively slow. So in this case, you would predict a large core for Saturn and a small core for Jupiter. And Tristan Guyot prefers this scenario because it matches exactly his models that he's been constructing for the last decade or so. So I would rather have a more in detail model of the evolution process of these planets to actually model how much effective convection would be, as how basically you need a convection model of the planetary atmosphere over giga-year timescale. A detailed evolution model is basically needed. And what happens, what can basically happen is you introduce stratified convection. You have different layers of different concentrations because it's this double diffusive behavior where you have a convective, a sort of a compositional gradient imposed to gravity. And it's like in the ocean of our ocean, you have different brines of different concentrations that lead to stratified convection. So similarly, that could happen in Jupiter. So one model has been put forth by LeConte and Chabrier. And in their model, they have, I don't know, a large number of convective cells. So I grew up learning about Jupiter that's basically there's one convective cell. So now they're saying there's 1,000. So I'm not sure that's really the ultimate change here, but there could certainly be more than one. So I think this is what I would like to say about Jupiter's interior. We are still working on extending these calculations to Uranus and Neptune, for example. And we also work with experiments, but that would be another talk to predict. So thank you very much.